Hallo zusammen, Boris hier. Bevor wir loslegen, noch ein kleiner Hinweis in eigener Sache. Ich bin nämlich am 20. Mai das erste Mal auf der Future Logistics in Duisburg. Die Future Logistics hat sich innerhalb von 4 Jahren zu einer der führenden Innovationsmessen der Logistikbranche entwickelt. Aber eigentlich ist die Future Logistics mehr als eine Messe, ist eigentlich mehr eine Plattform für den Austausch von Ideen, denn dort treffen sich Logistikverantwortliche und Entscheider aus der Industrie und dem Handel mit innovativen Startups und Investoren. Und ich bin der Meinung, dass dieser Austausch im Moment besonders wichtig ist. Deshalb freue ich mich auch besonders, dass ich mit meiner Felgendreher und Friends Crew Teil des Programms sein darf. Wir nehmen dort nämlich einen Live-Podcast auf der Bühne auf zum Thema Wie managt man Innovation in Zeiten von Unsicherheit? Das wird eine sehr spannende Diskussion werden und ich würde mich riesig freuen, wenn mich viele von euch am 20. Mai bei meinem Besuch auf der Future Logistics in Duisburg begleiten würden, damit wir uns da mal persönlich kennenlernen können. Das Team von Startport, das die Future Logistics organisiert, hat mir sogar versprochen, alle Hörer dieses Podcasts zum halben Preis in die Veranstaltung zu lassen. Dafür müsst ihr euch nur schnell anmelden und zwar unter www.futurelogistics-startport.de. Futurelogistics-startport.de. Und beim Kauf des Tickets müsst ihr dann einfach den Code Podcast eingeben und los geht's. Also, rauf auf die Webseite futurelogistics-startport.de und dann beim Ticketkauf den Code Podcast eingeben. Also, ich hoffe, ihr seid dabei und wir sehen uns am 20. Mai auf der Future Logistics in Duisburg. Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu Felgendreher und Friends, Diskussion für Supply Chain Fans. Ich bin euer Host Boris Felgendreher und ich melde mich heute mal mit einer, nicht Solo-Episode, aber es ist keine Episode, wo ich mit meinem großen Kreis von Leuten, mit meinen Friends oder mit anderen Leuten über ein Thema diskutiere. Ich habe heute einen einzelnen Gast bei mir und zwar einen Gast, der ein langjähriger Weggefährte von mir ist, Jonah McIntyre. Wir haben damals gemeinsam bei GT Nexus gearbeitet und in der Zwischenzeit auch schon viele gemeinsame Projekte gemacht, schon gemeinsam Podcast. Jedenfalls ist Jonah jemand, der viele, viele Jahre im Ausland verbracht hat. Er ist US-Amerikaner, hat viele Jahre in Europa gelebt, in Asien gelebt, in Neuseeland gelebt, hat viel erlebt, viel rumgekommen und ist jetzt gerade wieder zurück in die USA und ist gerade dabei, bei der Firma Trimble, der Mutterfirma von Transporeon, die Corporate Ladder zu erklimmen, ist gerade aufgestiegen zum Chief Technology Officer. Da kann er vielleicht gleich 1-2 Sätze drüber verlieren. Aber darüber soll es heute gar nicht gehen. Ich möchte heute nämlich mit Jonah über die Situation der Zölle sprechen. Ich möchte heute aber den Fokus darauf richten, welchen Einfluss die Zölle, die die USA erheben, besonders auf China, aber auch auf den Rest der Welt, was für einen Einfluss die auf die Logistik haben, ganz spezifisch auf die Logistik. Und da ist Jonah der Experte dafür, er ist ein absoluter Logistik- und Supply Chain- und auch Technologie-Experte, aber Technologie ist heute eher nicht so das Thema, sondern eher Situation so, wie er sie vor Ort wahrnimmt. Live aus Boulder, Colorado, habe ich es wahrscheinlich richtig wiedergegeben. Ja, genau. Jonah, ja genau, eigentlich könnten wir gleich auf Deutsch weitermachen, aber ich muss leider jetzt auf Englisch umwechseln, damit es Jonah etwas leichter hat. Jonah, welcome to Felgendreher and Friends, thanks for being on the program.
It's always a pleasure to be back with you. Pity that I can't do this in German up to the standards that you would want. But
yeah, AI is not quite there yet. It's on the brink of getting us there where everything will be simultaneously translated into any language, but we're just not quite there yet. It's technically possible.
It's coming. It's coming.
I've looked into it, yeah. But at this point we're stuck with me doing the intro in German and then switching into English. For our German audience, it's 100% basically German speaking, but most people also speak English, so hopefully they appreciate us doing this conversation today in English. So I caught you where? In Boulder, Colorado. That's why I'm doing it at nighttime. So whenever we talk about anything related to terrorists, we always have to mention the date because tomorrow and the day after, it's going to be a completely different story. So we're recording this nighttime, my time, on Monday, April 28th. So maybe tomorrow everything will be useless. But also let's just make this conversation a way where we focus on stuff that's not, you know, out of date by tomorrow or next week, but something that's obvious right now where it's definitely an impact. And we're going to get into that in a second. But there's a few things where people for weeks and months have been speculating about what's going to happen, what's not going to happen, and the impacts and so forth. Lots of speculation going on because we don't know what's happening because it's such a fluid situation. But there are a few things that are for sure right now. There are a few things that are happening as we speak or about to happen, regardless of what happens in the next couple of weeks in supply chain, in logistics, what's hitting the West Coast or what's not hitting the West Coast in terms of freight coming in or not coming in. And that's going to have a huge impact. And I feel like it's a little underreported story as we speak. There are some reports in the press, but at a very superficial level. That's why I wanted to ping you and dive into the tariff discussion that I've evaded so far. I've not covered any... Well, actually, I take that back. We talked about the tariffs early on in the year or late last year, where it was still like, yeah, Trump's going to use the tariffs as a negotiating ploy, as a negotiating tactic, right. And it's just isolated to getting stuff from China, fentanyl coming across the border, and that's what it's all about with Canada, and it's small scale. But, you know, that was the extent to how we talked about it. And again, mostly speculation, because all of that is down the drain now. But now, as we speak... Today, what's going on there? Give people a little bit of background. You've been working for Transporeon for a couple of years now, yeah. And now you're part of Trimble, which is the parent company of Transporeon. So you're very much, very closely aligned to the logistics sector. You're sailing into the logistics sector, so you have daily conversations with folks that are directly affected by what we're about to talk about today, right?
Yeah, I mean, my background's always been in logistics. I helped run logistics for U.S. Retailer globally, then helped create businesses for Manhattan Associates and solutions for Panalpina. I started several companies along the way in the space. That's how you and I intersected at GT Nexus when they acquired one of them. And if I look now at from the Trimble perspective in my current role, Trimble has a pretty significant position in the logistics sector in North America, pretty dominant, particularly on the carrier and brokerage side. So less shippers and more operators. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Transporeon has a pretty strong position in Europe. But let's not talk about that. Let's zero in on the sector. Yeah, it's pretty wild. If you sort of recap it, the last 100 days, and this is now 100 days into the administration, it'll be tomorrow, I believe it's Trump's 100th day in his administration. Before the administration took office, there was this question, there was a lot of dual messaging around tariffs are a negotiating tactic in order to achieve something else, or no tariffs are really the thing. They're intended to be an end, not just a means to an end. Now, I'm not sure if either one of those has really been played out, but what has been played out is stability is just out the window. We see the logistics flows, as you said, there's not projection. This is sort of real flows. Mm-hmm. There was a spike as people rushed to bring goods into the U.S. before various tariff deadlines that were announced and then moved and or not moved. But there's a sort of spike, an import spike, and now there's a very steep drawdown on import flows, but there isn't a commensurate increase in domestic flows, so that it's not like we're seeing manufacturing sort of light up really fast and capital intensive projects. The capital intensive projects that are going on are actually these private sector data center builds. The data centers is real big, kind of ongoing build that's still happening, but that's kind of it. So it's not a great outlook. Consumer sentiment's down. Expected GDP modeling from all the people who model it say it's going to go down, say that we're going to have a drawdown in 0.5% or something of GDP. The de minimis exemption that was bringing a lot of goods into the US, which essentially said you don't have to pay duties on relatively kind of reasonable value of goods if it was sent in through the parcel networks. That's been lifted for, or that's been rescinded for key countries that were shipping to the US. So Temu and Shine really significantly impacted that way. And then the introduction of tariffs, I mean, to the tariff levels that are in effect right now are still pretty significant. So if we look at the European trades, the tariff levels that were announced but then paused for 90 days while the two sides negotiate, those were 20% for most segments, but higher for, say, steel and automotive, 25% for steel and automotive. Mm-hmm. The 20% level were paused, but that just took them down to the 10% level, which was announced previously. And if you blend the 10% and the 25% categories and you take a weighted average, it means that the, as of today, the 28th of April, the goods are coming in, have a weighted average tariff from Europe of 15%. They were 1.5% 100 days ago. So there's a lot of products that they can sustain. You know, if you're importing very expensive wine or something, and the very expensive wine goes up by 15%, there's some demand elasticity. Yeah, it's going to go down, but people still... There's a lot of products that at 15% demand elasticity is severe. You know, people really won't import those things. So
yeah, so prices going up is one thing, but what's going to happen with some items that just completely are not ordered any longer from China, for example? Let's take toys. Like toys is, for example, one of the prime example of 80 plus something percent of toys that are sold in US come from China. Right. And they fell off a cliff, and other products, staple items that are on the grocery store shelves.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that worry you? Like what's going to happen? Like, because right now it feels like there's a little bit of a quiet before the storm, because the inventory is still there, but it's going to have a very, very sudden, very steep fall off a cliff. And what is that going to do?
Yeah. The beginning of my career was in supply chain or logistics for a toy company. If you look at that sector, so much of the volume of the year is done in the, you know, run up to Christmas and Christmas period. Those kind of orders won't really go missed for several more months, but they'll start pretty soon in the life cycle of orders are going in and beginning of summer, so that the goods can be in stores by mid-November so that they can be purchased starting mid-November up through Christmas. The kind of levies were, or the tariffs we're talking about, 125% on these goods, that's going to be noticed by consumers. You know, that there'll be some shift in behavior. Now, again, will they not buy the toys? Who knows? I think the more important question is not will they buy the toys or not, but will the businesses that bet their livelihood, their survival on them buying the toys, will they make the commit? Because it's not like the consumer can answer this question for us before a bunch of businesses have to make the commit, right? Mm. So I think the effect is they simply will not stock as much goods. And then we're in a physical industry, so when they don't have those goods in the stores, it's because it wasn't transported, it wasn't warehoused, you know, it wasn't imported, it wasn't custom cleared. Those are all the logistics factors. I essentially think the material economy is going to compress as a result of just from the uncertainty that's already taken place, because at this point, the credibility of the administration is gone for most businesses. It's been earnings seasons for a lot of companies announcing Q1 results. And if you go look at major US businesses, there's just this roll call of them trying to signal to the administration that this is not acceptable. This is not going, whatever the top line message of we're going to make America great and we're going to industrialize again, and it's not working. Perhaps there would have been some companies that were positive about this if it had just held, if there had been a level and it was announced and then it was held. But the erratic nature has meant that businesses aren't willing to put their money on the line, and there's no credibility for it being a stable.
At the same time, I heard that the bunch of CEOs of the largest retail chains, the Targets, the Walmarts of the world, for example, have recently met with the administration and walked away somewhat relaxed, thinking, okay, maybe there's something else going on. Maybe, you know, things aren't going to be as harsh as they seem right now, which is sort of the expectation of many in the market, where, as you said, this is not sustainable. This is never going to continue throughout the year. These tariffs are going to come back way, 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 way down.
Yeah.
And let's just assume that, and Trump has done this before, like a complete 180, and returns back to normal and says, okay, let's just postpone, and moves on to other things, and everything is back to normal, and the tariffs go back to normal to where they were before he started this entire campaign.
Yeah, let's play that scenario out for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Let's play that scenario out for a second. So let's say that on day 101, the administration says, actually, we've changed our mind. We're going to go back to what it was on day minus one. Mm-hmm. And we'll hold the line for the rest of the administration. And there's a lot of non-tariff related trade barriers and other things that are in motion here. So everything from like export controls on chips to tax cuts or non-cuts, because you have to remember the tariffs are a form of taxation. So they, in principle, at least when people are paying 15% weighted average on goods from Europe, that money then adds to government revenues. They can, in theory, turn around and say lower corporate taxes or lower personal taxes, and that changes consumption patterns. There's a bunch of like second, third order impacts, but stick with that for a second. There's already a lot of irreversible or very difficult to reverse moves that have happened. So as an example, during the last 100 days, they canceled and stopped issuing new build permits for solar capacity. And places, ironically, places that are really staunchly conservative, places like Texas, have a libertarian streak, and they're building more solar capacity than the rest of the U.S. combined. It's not because they are climate change believers per se, but they're sort of free market believers. But those developments still often need federal permits. And in the past, the federal permit was maybe the least restrictive part of the process. You go, you want to go build a solar farm in a highly regulated state like California, that's pretty tough. So the federal thing is a checkbox of 1,000 checkboxes. In Texas, it was maybe 100 checkboxes, and it was one of them. Now it's become like a blocking condition. I know companies that are in the logistics trade that specialize in these buildouts, and they downsized. They fired drivers. They sold off trailers and capacity. Now, could they go ramp that stuff up? Like, yeah, maybe. But do you ramp up as fast as you shut down? Like, no. So I think there's...
Well, at least the labor market in the U.S. is a little bit more flexible
more
than
liquid.
In Europe.
Yeah.
In Europe, there's literally nothing you can do. Oh, well, there's a little bit of Zeitarbeit, which is, where you temporarily put people on a special program. But yeah.
Capital markets is another one, though. So the combination of increased inflation from tariffs, the same service or good costs more in the future, right? And tariffs are inflating, like they lead to inflation. So... And then you have the Federal Reserve Bank in the U.S. has a dual mandate of keeping employment high and inflation low. Well, employment is high in the U.S. It's under 5% unemployment. This is like the envy of most of the world. But inflation is not going down anymore. It's likely to go up. And so they're going to, in order to meet that part of their mandate, they're going to keep rates higher. And in fact, bond markets have been trading against the U.S. debt, which that sort of sets the level for everything else. Like if you can earn 4.5% by holding debt of the U.S., then what are you going to charge like a trucking company that wants to invest in its business? It's going to be more than 4.5% because they have more risk. They're not going to be able to pay you back, right? So the cost of capital to do any kind of build out, change the vehicles, any of this stuff, the cost of even working capital, just covering fuel and everything, is increased, and that has to lead to a decrease in the investment into logistics sector, and that's not gonna reset quickly either. So I think, and then finally you have this do we believe it factor, which is, it's hard for me to envision companies that have made these painful transitions, which I know another, for example, that made a pretty significant outlay to buy a manufacturing site on the basis of the first announced wave of tariffs that then are furious at now owning a manufacturing site that is questionably economic April 28th. So if I look at that company, are they going to buy a second manufacturing site in the future based on the promise of the administration?
Yeah, which is sort of the ironic part, because at the end of the day, one of the big promises that is being made, why all of this is taking place, is that more manufacturing should be moved back to the U.S.
Yeah.
More companies should be encouraged to invest in the U.S. And I mean, I talk to a lot of folks. First of all, there's a complete holding pattern where people are like, okay, right now we're not making any investment decisions. Yeah. We're standing put. We're monitoring the situation. But as long as the shenanigans are going on, the less confidence I would have in invest in a country that is behaving like it is right now, which is very counterproductive, right?
Yeah. So in times like this, there's always somebody who goes from fear to greed, and they'll invest when everyone else is down. They'll be contrarian. They'll find a way to, they'll find a longer time horizon that they're willing to evaluate over something. But I think that pattern actually proves the whole, which is they are contrarian to the trend. Like the trend, which at a size of an economy like this, matters, right? You need the mass in order to really for this economy to work. The trend is to be cautious, or maybe even not to. My impression is there's a lot of people who, because of the pace of change, it's not that they're making a conscious decision to wait. It's that they're still processing the new information. Or information when new information comes in. So they can never really get themselves to make a decision, even with good intentions, because they're getting a constant flow. Imagine if there was like an ongoing crisis happening in your city and you were getting a steady stream of text messages or alerts, that steady stream would keep you glued to your phone, maybe longer than you should. Maybe the thing is to look at the first message, take action, and, you know, get out of your house or something. But if you're getting the steady stream, the nature of that steady stream is that it keeps you glued to your phone. I feel like a lot of decision makers are glued to their financial models, where they're just trying to make a decision, but it keeps updating too fast.
Yeah, now imagine like a German company with the executive team not being the most spontaneous or the easy to come to a conclusion or make quick decisions. They're in perpetual limbo. And decide forever and ever and ever. Yeah, but Jonah, let's go back to some more immediate situations along the West Coast in particular, the big harbors, for example, all of the inflowing flows that you talked about that are about to come to a standstill. What are those going to do to the logistics sector, especially on the West Coast, on the LA Long Beach harbors, on the warehouses, on the trucking companies on the West? What's happening there? Because, you know, a lot of people have pointed this out. We have a situation here that's not unlike what we saw during COVID, right?
Yes.
It's a very, very sudden disruption.
Yeah.
And here's a little bit of a heads up because it's clear that it's coming. But what is going to happen, you know, when really shit hits the fan and there's no more ships coming in or way less goods being processed in the ports and everything that's tied to the ports, for example?
Yeah. I mean, you have a couple actors here. So there's a lot of people with pretty firm kind of commitments to those ports. Like if you're a port operator, not a whole lot else you can do. You're a port operator, you operate the port. If it doesn't if it doesn't have goods coming through it, you just scale down whatever variable cost you have.
Union workers who are still employed and who cannot easily be let go and for good reasons, and they're there waiting and getting paid as they wait.
You have to remember this like web of how this impacts the whole ecosystem. So a lot of those ports, those ports are owned or partially owned or pay significant funds into a local government of some kind. Maybe the state government, might be the county, it might be the city. But somehow, you know, when their cost base gets underwater or because they have a bunch of unionized contracts or whatever. So who's on the line for that? Well, there's some bondholders that'll be on the line for that. They can declare bankruptcy. They issue bonds. They're not going to pay those bonds back. But a lot of that like true cash flow impact is going to go to the local governments, right? And so whatever services they provide are then going to be diminished as a result. And then that leads on to other businesses, right? So you have this like downstream cycle effect.
So we're already into second and third order consequences of the immediate thing there.
But then, so what are they going to do? They're going to slash anything that is controllable expense and variable expense, right? To get in line with lower volumes. Then you got the companies that are going in and out of these ports with rail or truck. The rail operators are much like the port operators, you know, good luck slashing those costs. Those are unionized workforce, very, very much fixed asset. You can have less trains going back and forth. The exports are actually, if anything, more impacted, I think, than the imports. Imports are most of them are kind of consumer discretionary goods. There's some things that are industrial goods, but in both cases, there's a lot of inelastic goods, things that people are just going to pay for anyway. They'll have to pay more, but they'll do it. I think the exports are easier for trade partners to target. Mm. And there's a kind of a backlash in a lot of markets, Europe included. Right. So if anything, like the exports are maybe the worst for the rail providers. Then you've got the trucking companies. The trucking companies will first try to shift capacity. So drivers, tractors, less trailers, because those are more specialized, over into other markets, but there aren't other markets that are picking this up. So, because at least in the first Trump, this isn't supposed to be a negative view on Trump. I'm just describing like the actual facts on the ground. In the first administration, there were things like trying to get Foxconn to build a site in the Midwest. We were going to build a big, beautiful wall. There were like building things. It's not really that happening right now. It's more like sanitizing we're cleaning things up. So we're cleaning up government by removing, you know, the waste. We're cleaning up the universities by removing the DEI initiatives. It's really not about building in the way that libertarian conservatives would think about, like, unlocking free markets. It's more like getting it ideologically aligned. And so what that means for these drivers, these trucks, these warehouses that are staging facilities for the drayage of the containers that then get devanned and put on trucks is they don't have any place else to go. Like the next biggest rising transport demand is infrastructure build out for data centers, because it happens to be this intersect between, it's not politicized or it's politicized slightly in favor of the current administration, and it's private money. And because the nature of these data centers, they have less intersection than, say, like green energy initiatives with either needing grants or needing permission from a federal government. So they don't slow down as much. That's like the next best thing to go to if you're a trucking company. These data centers are, it's like building like a new data center, new generation data center would be like building 100 previous generation data centers all together. You know, they use the electricity of a city, like 150,000 person city to run the data center. I mean, these are really, and there's a lot of flavors of these. There's some that are being built around stranded energy assets. So you get these places like in West Texas where, yeah, there's a bunch of gas being flared off or there's a bunch of solar panels there, but getting the electricity out is hard. But if you could put the data center there and then you pipe the data in and out, especially with AI workloads where you don't need it to be very fast going in and out, it's okay if it's a little slower. That's the kind of construction projects we're talking about.
Okay, so going back to just the immediate impacts that we are going to see on the logistics sector. So we're saying, okay, flows will dry up and it's going to be very sudden. How long?
Yeah, it's already started. Yeah.
It's already started, but how long can the sector survive? And what's going to happen when things pick back up? Because we always see these whiplash effects that are going on. We saw that during COVID, right? When you bring things to a standstill and suddenly, you know, the lockdown is lifted, for example, all of a sudden consumption starts again and flows are starting to happen again. This leads to another whole new set of of effects that you really can't predict. But what's your best take on how this one unfold? Because of course the flows will not stop indefinitely. I think we all agree at this point that they will pick up in some fashion because tariffs will go down again. What's your best take?
Like, I don't know. I would, on the tariffs going down, I don't know. Of course, like you and me, we would not have predicted the willingness of the current administration to impose this much pain on the economy for like a kind of an ideological purpose. I'm not saying I'm not saying I agree or disagree with the ideology, but that is the context here is there's a vision of how the economy should be organized, and then there's a pain budget that they're willing to spend to get to that. And I would not have guessed they would have gone this far. So who's to say that we are anywhere near the floor of this? Like, I don't know. I'm not saying I think they'll go further, but I would not put my money on it one way or the other. In terms of the logistics sector, what we see is some degree of consolidation going on. So there's companies going out of business. There's companies that are being, you know, merged in and acquired. And I think typically the way this sector works in the U.S., now we're talking warehousing and transportation, is a bit like maybe the employment market in Japan, where you've got maybe half of the employment market in Japan is like kind of lifetime employees, very stable. And the other half, in order to give the economy the flexibility it needs, the liquidity it needs, they're on very short-term, very, you know, risky contracts. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. market's got, particularly you think about things like LTL, you've got these big names, big fleets, big operations, very heavy capital intensive kind of outlays to get a network going and get it up to scale. But you got a lot of people who who provide the flexibility by being mom and pop operations that kind of come and go on a fast cycle. I think what we're going to see is the people who take the biggest hit, who absorb the majority of the downturn, are going to be the mom and pops like usual. And then when the market turns, there'll be a chance for people to make money because there won't be as much capacity, or if the market turns. I don't know if it ever will. We, for a long time, were, me and people around me were thinking about this as we're in a freight recession, both in Europe and the US, and thinking about, well, what happens when the market turns? I don't know. I mean, maybe we're at the apex right now. We're not in a freight recession. We're in the peak, and maybe it's going to get a lot worse, not better.
Yeah, yeah. I recall a conversation that last year when we were talking about, you know, reorganization of supply chains and reshoring and nearshoring, yeah, all these topics. And, you know, there was the opinion always, you know, from folks from the logistics sector saying, well, we don't really care where stuff is made or where it's transported. We always have stuff to transport, whether it's produced in the US or in China. But now it's turning out to be very short-sighted, because what you're seeing right now could easily suppress the entire world economy, where flows in general across the world are going to come down, and that is going to affect the bottom line of every logistics company out there.
Totally. A common example that's given is in the US is Nike. Nike's shoes are quite popular. They're a great, you know, they're a great iconic brand. Their shoes are subject to 125% tariff if they're made in China, or, you know, 45% tariffs if they're made in Vietnam or whatever, you know, kind of go by the country. Now, will people still buy very nicely designed, you know, performance sneakers 40% more expensive than they are or they were a couple months ago? Yeah. I mean, yes, but are they going to buy as many of them? Like, no, there's got to be some demand elasticity. And so people are saying, well, it doesn't really matter where they're made, we'll transport them. It's like, no, you won't. There won't be as many of them. That's what this means. Like, the physical economy the whole economy will reduce, but the physical economy will reduce disproportionately to the other, to like the services economy, for example. And there won't be as much to transport. That's the outcome.
Yeah. Do you see any silver lining? I mean, I'm struggling to find any positive aspects of it. I mean, it's
no, I don't. I guess it depends on what you're scoring things on. So, you know, what I would be scoring things on are, because I'm maybe a kind of a child of globalization. Most of my career was around the trend of globalization, even though it's been retracting now for some years. But, you know, I would be looking for, are we lifting the bottom segment of societies up in terms of health, in terms of longevity, kind of access to education and kind of material well-being? And that would have been in particular for the logistics sector. I'd be looking at things like, are we growing the segment? Are we serving both the customers better? So a shipment that 30 years ago would have taken a week and cost a fortune now is like 2 days and cost a very reasonable price. And are we going to continue that trend for our customers? And then for us, are we able to, you know, create meaningful careers, meaningful businesses and meaningful returns for investors? None of these are well served. None of these have a positive silver lining, in my opinion, so far. So I think you'd have to reach into more ideological questions, like how self-sufficient should an economy be, or what portion of the government revenue is paid for by people who are engaging in business with foreigners, something like that. Like, those are quite abstract goals, but if you had those goals, then yeah, maybe there is a silver lining.
Yeah, maybe I'll add to that I think just adding to what you just said, that there are some aspects, I'm talking about Germany and Europe now,
yes,
some aspects where we have to be more independent. And finally, that's like a wake-up call.
Yes. Yeah.
Talking about
yeah.
defense, for example, but also just items that you need to run a successful European Union, for example. You can't be as dependent on other regions as we currently are. And if at the end of the day, this enables us to be more self-sufficient and independent, that will be good not only for Europe, but also for the rest of the world.
Yes.
Except for a couple of players who wish it to be otherwise, but... I think that's a good thing. If that leads to us waking up, that we can't always rely on other folks to bail us out on stuff. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although I would put this in the category, you ever meet people who they've been through, say, cancer or some other, you know, maybe they were in a plane accident or something. They went through some horrible thing, and they'll sometimes describe, you know, but I'm stronger for having gone through that, or it made me a better person or something. Okay, that may be true, but that doesn't mean they wanted to go through it. Like, if they could do it over again, they probably wouldn't go through the hardship. And I would put, for example, you know, the important and necessary instigation of like a true military, you know, kind of significant military posture in Europe and being able to defend their own borders. Like, yeah, I'm for that. Like, I'm a believer in that, but it's a shame that these things are happening,
of course,
as a result of such a negative.
And it's amazing how quickly opinions about defense tech in general have changed. Even myself, like just a few years ago, I was like, seriously, I mean, are we really going to spend that much money on tanks and this and that and on the military? And now I'm like, oh wow, we should be in front and center.
We're definitely going to spend that much money on.
We should spend a lot of money, and we should be like a hotbed of innovation for all these technologies that can also be used in other ways, like drone technologies, you know, autonomous robots, and all of
machine
this stuff.
Vision and
all of this stuff that is not only good for military purposes, which we need to defend ourselves, but also very useful in a lot of other contexts, especially in the logistics sphere, for example.
Yeah.
You know, how many times we've talked about how great it would be to have drones, for example. It's a showstopper if the prices are too high and if they're not, you know, usable in the logistics sense. Well, maybe it will happen in a few years, because now there's a major push to develop those types of technologies for the defense sector. So, well, I'm grasping now to find a silver lining.
You're right. Like this is where no one would have wished the war in Ukraine, for example. It's horrible on so many levels, and yet they are likely to emerge as kind of the center of military research, the sort of next wave of military equipment, at least R&D, if not manufacturing, in Europe. Their drone capabilities are better than the U.S. capabilities in many ways. You know, the U.S. may have some very high-end drones that are superior, but their cost for performance is, you know, 1,000x or something. And the capabilities that we see, they're necessitated by the war conditions, the battlefield conditions, mean that they're coming out. But just to go back to your question, like, nobody should be saying like, oh, what's the silver lining of the war in Ukraine? It's just a tragedy on so many levels. The fact that it has something coming out of it that's positive is just grossly outweighed by the negative. That's how I feel about the U.S., but also worldwide, the tariff situation.
Yeah, just for the sake of predictions, and we said earlier, we don't know what's going to happen next few days. We're recording this on April 28th. I predict that the next few days, it's not going to be 2 weeks, it's going to be less than 2 weeks, we're going to have major announcements that the tariffs, at least for China, are rolled back dramatically. Or there are so many loopholes being put into it that you can still keep up the outside picture of the tariffs are still there, but you're making so many exceptions for all the big retailers, for all the technologies, for all of the stuff that that Americans need, that it's basically not any longer what it's once proposed to be, and that's sort of a face-saving way out. That would be my prediction if I was a betting man.
I mean, the meta pattern
of course,
this,
Jonah, again, it flies in the face of the entire plan of having tariffs be a major source of income to the U.S., right? And bringing back manufacturing to the U.S., for example, and through all this huge sums of money that are coming in through tariffs, you can now get rid of income tax and all kinds of stories that I've heard that, of course, flies in the face of that. But I don't think there's a way around it, because the immediate pain will be so large that there's no other way than to reverse course. That will be my prediction if I was a betting man.
I have a couple scenarios in my mind that are pretty extreme, but the current administration is toying with extreme. And to, you know, who am I? Like, you and I have known each other for years, and, you know, I'm willing to like entertain the atypical or the contrarian perspective. And I can see some upside to having an administration that is willing to ask questions like, well, you know, maybe we ought to be heading towards, I don't know, 15% flat income tax. But we have to make up the money somewhere. So we essentially tax consumption in the same way that, say, Europe has a VAT tax, which the US doesn't have the equivalent of something like this. So I could see some sense in having like big picture questions, willing to revisit big picture things. So just to mention a couple that I could imagine taking place, the US is in the lead on topics of AI, right? Like it's, there's a very real chance that this is the engine of growth for the world economy, for everything that services, and to some degree for things that are goods, because a lot of goods are, right? You know, if you think about a car, it's got all the design, it's got a ton of information that goes into it. I could imagine a world where the US is in effect exporting its AI capabilities, and that's its primary export. So it's not physical goods, it's sort of services. And then it's buying back from the rest of the world physical goods like Vietnam, but that's, sneakers.
Isn't that what's been happening last 20 years with Amazon, but, and Google and Facebook and Microsoft?
Yeah, but with a caveat that the US sort of revenue is tied to taxing this inbound goods flow. Because if you think about what happens right now, when there's 10 billion or something in AI spend, there's income taxation on that in the US, corporate taxes in the US, and all the smart people who are making those things, they get taxed on their income. So we're essentially taxing the export, the major, you know, unique export. And it might be that there's some sort of a rebase that's like, well, we try to diminish the taxation on that. This is almost like industrial policy along the lines of China giving a special helping hand to battery companies or something, because that's what they want to build expertise in and capacity in exporting it. So I can imagine something along those lines that is putting... It's just the current administration is so focused on physical economy goods, they pigeonhole to that. I could imagine a model where they expand it and go, you know what, actually, the trade balance we're looking for, it includes services. And then we
which
get
was the most ironic part of the tariff charts that totally left that out of the picture, where the US is so dominant in all these technology services that you provide all over the world. When I use a Google, when I use the software to talk to you and pay, you know, that goes to... that goes to US company, and it's, you know, the US is absolutely leading all over the place with those types of digital services, for example. But Jonah, since we're on the topic of betting, I don't know if you recall this, but a few years ago, and this was before the war in Ukraine started, we had a podcast conversation and we were on the topic of betting markets, and you said that you're quite keen on having a look at what betting markets are predicting. And you were mentioning back in the days that there was a certain chance that Russia would invade Ukraine by X date. And you said that percentage is higher than you expected, and that should be reason for alarm.
Yeah, and then they invaded.
And I remember thinking, oh, that's sort of very out there. I think that's never going to happen.
Yeah, there's a number of ways. I think this goes into this general question of, like, how does one form a expectation of the future. Actually, recently I did a 360 exercise with people around me in my organization, and I was asking, where do I add value, right? We sort of narrowed it down to a couple buckets, and 50% of the weighting for how does Jonah add value, it was correctly anticipating the future. Now, that's not perfect. I made a bunch of mistakes, but then you can go into questions of, like, well, what tactics do you use to anticipate the future? And I think this is one of them. You look at where people are willing to put concrete money on something. Now, sometimes that's a bet, like a war in Ukraine is a bet. But to give you another example for that your listeners would know about, go spend some time looking at the companies that would be the most impactful in a rebuilding effort in Ukraine. So what is Ukraine going to need when they start their rebuilding? They're going to need things like glass. Okay. So where's that glass going to be transported from? Well, depends on what happens at the end of the war. It might come from Russia or their satellites, or it might come from up the Black Sea, but it's likely to come from Poland. Like, that's where a lot of the glass is going to come from. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, so that glass is one of these things that when you transport glass, you have to have special equipment to load it, unload it, and transport it. There's been a spike in the acquisition, so like the concentration basically of, but through acquisition of people in the logistics sector preparing for rebuilding efforts in Ukraine. So if you go look at who are specialized companies that you would need to rebuild a country, and this glass is just one of these examples, there's others. And the question is, like, well, where's the money going? Like, are people investing in that capacity? Are they forming concentrations? And it's increasing. And that would tell me that there's at least some money being placed on the bet that this war is going to go down to a level. I'm not sure they're going to have to be at peace, but it's going to, the intensity of the fighting is going to go down to a level where rebuilding efforts start to happen. And therefore, if you're well positioned, say, to get glass in and out of the country, then you can benefit from that.
Well, let's hope that that prediction is true this summer on too, and we'll soon see some peace in that part of the region. But Jonah, thanks again. As always, very insightful. We should do this more often. Maybe have you on regularly on the program if people enjoy your insights. That'd be fun. Jonah, thanks again. Congrats on your new job there at Trimble, and keep it up and keep us informed. And I'll talk to you next time.
Great. Thanks.